Are you tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. Today I'm going to chat with journalist, author, activist, analyst, Paul Street. And I'll let Paul tell you a little bit more about himself. So stay tuned and we'll be right back with Paul Street. Paul Street, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you very much, Cindy. Glad to be here.
Well, it's really nice to have you on. I've admired your work for quite a while, and I'm glad to finally have you on the Soapbox. But
thank you.
Before we get into, what the interview is about, tell my listeners a little bit about yourself.
Oh, gee. Well, I taught history for years. I have a doctorate in it. I was what was sort of called a Marxist historian. Taught in the adjunct market for, God, seems like forever. Finally got out of that and into contemporary policy stuff, research, worked in that for years. I was a research director of a black civil rights organization in Chicago for many years. And then when Bush ordered the invasion of Iraq and after 9/11, I really started upping my presence as a contemporary political writer and an online writer. And particularly I started at Zenit. When the Obama phenomena emerged, I had a ground zero front row seat for the real Obama, as opposed to the fake progressive national brand Obama, because I was from Chicago. I was
right.
from Obama's neighborhood, and I actually dealt with Obama. And I started writing a lot of stuff about the Obama phenomena and started getting picked up at Black Agenda Report. Ended up writing books about the Obama phenomena and what a deception it was. And, I'm very eclectic across topic, but I work a lot with Dr. Martin Luther King's, what he called the triple evils that are interrelated.
Right.
The connection between racism, capitalism, and imperialism. And, of course, a whole bunch of other evils as well. And lately, in the last, few years, I've become very big on the climate issue. I think I'm somewhat belated with that. And I branched out to Counterpunch and Truth House and just all kinds of places. So, I don't know. That's a thumbnail.
Well, thank you, Paul. The reason that I contacted you to be on the show is because there was this, when you talk about the deception of Obama, let's make this clear.
Sure.
We're not talking about him being born in Kenya or anything like that. I mean, many people, since Obama's been president, they have called us things like, well, me for sure, things like teabagger, what are you now, Cindy, a Republican, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But we're actually valid criticism from the left.
Right, yeah. No, when I say the Obama deception, that's right. I'm not talking about his birth certificate. I will say this, however, actually being from the south side of Chicago, I grew up in the neighborhood that Obama claims to be from. I will say I used to get very irritated at how many times Obama would refer to himself as being, this skinny guy with big ears with a strange name from the south side of Chicago. I know very well that Barack grew up in Honolulu and went to a very privileged elite
right.
school there. I will throw a territorial thing in there. I actually grew up in the neighborhood that Obama claims to be from. But yeah, right, exactly. The deception that we're talking about is that he was some sort of anti-war, social justice, left-leaning, progressive you know, who wanted to fight the corporations, you know, and bring about, you know, progressive change for working people and all of that. And as I said, I knew Obama from early on. I knew the Illinois and Chicago Obama phenomenon for the national one. And I knew very well that you don't rise up in Mayor Daley's Chicago and Rod Blagojevich's Illinois. He's being some kind of a leftist. And in fact, he had a whole different history in Illinois and Chicago that I knew very well. It's very conservative, but working with Republicans. Had nothing to do with all these hopes, all these hokey, changey, leftist illusions that so many liberals and leftists were projecting out upon him that had nothing absolutely whatsoever to do with his real legacy. And so, you know, a lot of the early writing I did, along with the writing that Glenn Ford and Bruce Dixon were doing at Black Agenda Report, some of the stuff that the late Alexander Coburn was doing at Counterpunch, we pretty much tried to warn people about this illusion, about this branding, about this false projection, and pretty much predicted the entire trajectory of the Obama administration. And now you hear liberals, and now I live in Iowa City, and Kathy sounds like this, and they're disappointed and surprised at how right-wing Obama's been. But of course now they're going to redeem themselves and the Democratic Party, I guess, by sealing the burn of the nominally socialist Scandinavia fan Bernie Sanders.
Well, let's... That's a great segue to the actual topic of the interview is that, you know, I think I'm calling this show Don't Get Burned Again, BERNED again.
Sure.
But, pardon me?
That's good. I like that. Yeah. That's interesting, yeah.
But there's just, and that has so many, like, layers to it.
Yeah.
You know, first of all, Bernie Sanders, like Obama, isn't the candidate or person that like you call and Jeffrey St. Clair calls him, the Sandernistas, project onto him. So you just recently wrote an article for Counterpunch, and I thought it would be great to go over the bullet points about it was the right on schedule, the bullet points about it. But before we go on the bullet points about your most recent article, tell my listeners about like how he is, you say nominally a socialist, but also nominally an independent, because he votes with the Democratic Party more than some Democrats do.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, he actually was explicitly asked recently in an interview what he meant when he said, "Well, he doesn't actually say socialism." That's the funny thing.
Right.
I've been to a number of Bernie events because, you know, I'm in the middle of the ground zero of all this presidential stuff since I'm in Iowa, so I've seen a couple of Bernie things. I heard him say socialism once. And when I see him interviewed, you know, he doesn't exactly run from the label, but when he's asked by it, by George Stephanopoulos or by more recently Ezra Klein of the Washington Post, he just kind of in this kind of vague kind of way refers to Scandinavia. He says we ought to be more like them. And of course they have very social democratic things over there that I think a lot of us in the United States would probably like to have, including single-payer insurance and a much better safety net and so on and so forth. But he never says that. So what he really means, I mean, he's really sort of a populist.
Right.
And maybe a little bit of sort of vaguely a social democrat. So, you know, I don't entirely know what people mean when they say, I mean, socialism to me has always meant people's control, and particularly working people's control and workers' control of the economy and of society, you know, and bottom-up, rank-and-file, you know, power to the people. You don't hear anything about that from him. So that's kind of why I say, along with Glenn Ford, nominal socialist. As for being a Democrat, that's also, I mean, as for being an independent, that's also been very nominal and very sort of deceptive for a very long time. I mean, that goes all the way back, really, to the beginning of his career in the U.S. Congress. He was technically an independent mayor of, you know, kind of liberal progressive Burlington, Vermont in the 80s. I mean, that's true. But when he ran for Congress, technically as an independent, in 1988. He split the vote with a Democrat and a Republican won, and he took the lesson of that from that point on to really be a de facto Democrat, and he cut a deal with the Vermont Democratic Party where he would be technically independent because that kept his supporters in Burlington happy. But he would block any serious efforts at third party formation. And as it evolved over time, the Democrats agreed to put him on the ballot line every time he ran for the House. And then this continued on when 2000, when he ran for the U.S. Senate. He would be on the ballot line as a Democrat in the primaries. He would win. And then he would technically repudiate his Democratic nomination and claim to be a Democrat. But while he was in the House, and particularly since he's been in the Senate, he's also cut a deal with the Democratic leadership, whereby he votes with them. He votes with them on pretty much all procedural matters, and he votes with them pretty much on all policy matters. In fact, that's absolutely right. He's had a voting record more with the Democratic Party than some left Democrats. And if he does those things, and he almost never breaks from form on that, he gets to have de facto Democratic Party seniority mm-hmm. on committees, just as if he were a lifelong, full-blown Democrat. So, you know, that's a Democrat, and of course she's been very supportive of Democratic wars. When he likes wars, when they're ordered by Democratic presidents. So when Clinton bombed Serbia, he was all gung-ho for that and fought his own anti-war protesters in Vermont. He was for Obama's bombing of Libya. It's just the horrors of what Israel has done to Gaza and to Palestine. He's been on their side along with the right-wing Democrats. So, you know, independence is a very deceptive thing. And the thing is that in this presidential thing, I've heard him do this in Iowa. He kind of makes this big storyline about how he supposedly agonized whether to give up his independent status. And he finally decided that you can't run as a third party because then you just become a spoiler, you know, like evil Ralph Nader. Mm-hmm. Or I guess evil Jill Stein. Did he just agonize and really had to go back into the Democratic Party? That's very, very deceptive. He has been a de facto Democrat for 25 years.
Well, yeah, I mean, I have a whole, opposition to the entire system. I call it the electoral industrial complex in the place. But when Bernie decided to become a member of the Democratic Party to run, that's when, you know, I just kind of said, oh, well, then forget about it. I'm not even, besides the fact that I know that he's not as great as everybody claims that he has been as a senator, as a congressperson, when he decided to run as a Democrat, that just like stopped it for me. That was just like I was at that point.
Well, you know, Cindy, I'm kind of with like you in that regard, in the sense that I do my protest voting mm-hmm. every 4 years. I vote for the Ralph. I vote for the Jill Stein. Mm-hmm. I've always done this. Go back forever. I used to vote for the Socialist Workers Party.
Right.
Even in 1988. I remember one of my earliest things as a young man being involved in politics was Barry Commoner in 1980. I remember campaigning. But you know, I don't personally make that big a deal out of electoral politics,
right.
Because of the nature of our electoral system, which to me is—it's not just the money, it's not just the media. I mean, it's constitutionally set up in such a way as to block serious efforts at popular sovereignty, particularly at viable third and fourth parties. And I've always agreed with something that Howard Zinn used to say, which is that you know it's not really about who's sitting in the White House. That's not the critical thing. It's not who's sitting in the streets. You know, it's about who's exercising pressure day to day, you know, beneath and beyond what Noam Chomsky has called these personalized, quadrennial, extravaganza, you know, whatever their outcome, which frankly, we don't have a lot of impact on what their outcome is going to be.
Right.
That has a lot more to do with money than media. And, you know, and the variable we do have some control is how, I think, is how we focus our energies. And, you know, presidential elections, so like the Democratic Party, presidential elections again and again and again. I'm not a young man anymore, so I've seen this for a while. I've been the graveyard of social movements, of the real politics that matters. You know, the grassroots movement building, which is difficult, everyday, painstaking work. And,
right.
and I think people like the easy politics.
Right.
Or I don't vote for somebody. What does that take? I mean, it takes 2 minutes. I mean, that sounds slow. But actually, for me, the early voting at the Iowa City Public Library, I've done it in 3 minutes. You know, I won't blow my protest vote for Jill Sethi in 3 minutes, and I'm out of there. And it's a much more relevant question is, what did I do the day before that
right. And
the day after that? Now, here in Iowa, they're trying to build a pipeline carrying fracked gas through 17 counties from North Dakota down to the Mississippi River. We've got a new drone war air base in Des Moines. We have some of the most polluted waterways and streams in North America because of big agriculture. I mean, I could go on with the issues. We have a horrible race disparity in our incarceration rate. And, you know, again and again, I see this quandary of presidential candidate center freak show come into this state and hover over it for 6 months, 23, 27, 2011, 2015, and suck up all the political energy. And then you see very little left for an anti-war movement and very little left for an environmental movement. So, you know, I tell people, if voting makes you feel good, you know, do it.
Right.
Whatever. I mean, they're going to do it. They're just, you can't stop them. People are into it. It's almost like an American religion. We've been raised to believe that this is how you affect change. And I can't stop it. But as I say, it makes you feel good, but please come back to the real day-to-day politics of, you know, pick your issue. I think we need to combine more of our person. I think that's the urgent task, to pull together our issues and have one big movement that's here every day. You know, pick your issues or your issues and stay with them and fight on them day to day after these candidates, because they will leave. The caucus will be over here in Iowa on January 3rd, and the reporters will go away, and the CNN trucks won't be down the block anymore, and we're going to have our real life and the real struggles we need to fight. We're fighting for a decent minimum wage right here at the county level in Iowa City, and it's a worthwhile struggle.
Well, you know, that brings up so much stuff to me, and thank you for you know, articulating that. The only reason that I even, you know, I wrote a book called The Obama Files, Chronicles of an Award-Winning War Criminal, and it was like 500 pages. It was 500 pages of my articles since he was inaugurated, and I had to cut it back to 250 pages. And, you know, the only reason I focus on people like Obama and focus on people like Sanders is, like, what better way to expose the system than to expose people like this? And then, you know, just remember when Obama was running, and I was running for Congress at the time against Nancy Pelosi.
Sure.
And so when Obama was running, people would tell me, Cindy, you know, it's like what FDR said, we have to make him do it. And Obama would say, we have to make him do it. And then as soon as Obama was inaugurated, as soon as he started drone bombing the innocent people of Afghanistan and Pakistan, I said, where the hell are you guys? Oh, we, you know, give him a chance. Then it turned into give him a chance, Cindy.
Right. Yes. You know, I heard that was the line at The Nation, right? And other of the so-called left vanguard, really liberal democratic institutions, Katrina Vandenhoeven, you say this again and again. You know, apparently in the 30s, FDR did say that. Franklin Roosevelt said that.
Right.
And I think he may have meant it to labor leaders. You know, I've been looking for where Obama ever said that. And the best I could ever find, you know, make me do something progressive.
Uh-huh.
I mean, first of all, there's the morality of that. Why do I have to make, if you're progressive, why do you need to make you do something? You would do it because you believed it. If you really, you know, if you really honored the statue of Martin Luther King Jr. that stands behind you in the Oval Office, Mr. President, you wouldn't require me persuade you to be opposed to what Israel is doing to the children in Gaza. Right. You know, but the closest I heard to him, I can kind of say, is in Montclair, New Jersey in 2007. He sort of said something that like that to a Palestinian activist, you know, so, well, make me be decent on Israel. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, make me do it. When his administration started, there were people protesting for nationalization of the banks and breaking up the banks and protesting and going to the 1% of households in Connecticut and Manhattan. And he loaded up and pushing into all kinds of anger. There was public opinion data. And he was just loaded up in his administration with people from Wall Street and doing everything that Wall Street people wanted to do. And Rahm Emanuel, who at that time was his chief of staff, who's now the corporatist mayor of my dear old city of Chicago, yes, used to go to weekly meetings with the so-called progressive movement in Washington and yell at them and curse at them and at civil rights people and environmentalists and tell them to shut up and be quiet, basically cuss them out. Say shut up. It wasn't exactly some of this administration that wanted to be pushed by progressives. It was telling progressives to shut up and lecturing them on the need to be quiet. And then when there was this remarkable moment in the late summer and fall of 2011, and you had this magnificent, rapid fire populist movement called Occupy broke out from coast to coast. The Obama administration's Department of Homeland Security worked with Democratic Party mayors and city councils in hundreds of cities across this nation to infiltrate, to spy on, and ultimately to physically dismantle that populist people's economic movement at the same time that they worked to steal the rhetoric of Occupy and use it against Mr. 1% Romney, right, in the presidential election in 2012, on top of which I could tell you stories about the Obama administration and then the Rahm Emanuel administration's unbelievable military state police presence in Chicago in May of 2012 to crush people who were there to protest against NATO.
Right.
And originally GA. So, you know, make me do it, right. And then you're signing off on a police state that crushes people trying to press for progressive change.
Well, you know, I got arrested in front of the White House. I don't even know how many times when Bush was president. And I was wondering, sure, and then of course I followed him to Crawford, Texas, and got arrested there. So I was like starting to feel like he would be.
Well, you see, and that's very important, Cindy, because you know I wrote a book called Empire and Inequality in 2004. I was very politicized and by Bush and by the invasion of Iraq, and you know, and it's very important that you have that history too, because when people tell you, when liberals accuse you of being a teabag or a right winger, you got to say to them, and I do this for myself too, you don't have anything on me when it comes to fighting Bush and fighting the Republicans.
Right.
I mean, I wrote a bitter and acerbic book with my colleague Tony DiMaggio called "Crashing the Tea Party." I have no illusions about the right wing. I'm not a fan of them at all. And I probably fought the right wing and the Republicans more energetic than any of the liberals. And in fact, part of my criticism of the Obama phenomenon and the Democratic Party, of which Sanders is part generally, you know, is precisely that they haven't done anything really to fight the right. And the weakness of what passes for liberal and progressive change right now is precisely what creates an opening for this hard proto-fascistic right wing
exactly
to become as powerful. Right. You know, as it is. You know, it dawned on me when I was in Chicago at the time, we had these incredible demonstrations. I mean, the outpouring, I'll never forget them. Two nights in a row, we owned the Outer Drive in Chicago. We owned Michigan Avenue for two nights. Now, it finally dawned on me that half of those people, particularly the richer people, pouring out of the apartment buildings along the lake, weren't really there to protest imperialism or war as such. They were there to protest Bush. And that if it had been a President Al Gore who had invaded Iraq,
right,
or later a President Barack Obama, they would have sat on their hands and found a reason to be okay with it. You know, it's just something, it's just amazing how imperial policies that liberals hate you know, when a kind of a gruff Texas-speaking cowboy Republican white guy is doing them. But when they're supported by a slick-talking black liberal, supposedly liberal Democratic politician like Obama, or for that matter, a nominally socialist senator like Sanders, and you know, everything's fine.
I do want to talk about Sanders and his... He's already said that he will support the Democratic nominee, that Hillary Clinton is a good friend of his and he admires her. But I want to tell you a quick story about Obama before we get into that, because I can't believe we're almost out of time. So I got an email from the chairperson of the Progressive Democrats of America. And she told me, like, this was a personal email from her to me. She told me that she and Tikkun, which is Rabbi Michael Lerner's so-called progressive Jewish organization, were on a conference call with Barack Obama, the, you know, the president of the United States. And this was just recently. And she said, Cindy... And this was all about the Iran thing, because, you know, they have this this treaty with Iran about Iran not getting a nuclear weapon, even though Israel has hundreds and the United States has thousands. But anyway, the Republicans are going to try and derail it, I guess, that treaty. But they're out on their vacation right now, right? And so... The chairman of the Progressive Democrats of America said, Cindy, Obama was begging us. He said, we need the anti-war movement out in the streets right now because, you know, this is a good time to attack the Republicans. And I told this person, I said, you have to be kidding me. I said, I was just in Washington, D.C. in March. I got arrested trying to demand this war criminal. Obama is drenched in blood. Demand this war criminal end his wars. And this is when he started bombing Libya. I got arrested. I spent 60 hours in shackles. And then I got a stay away order from the White House for 6 months. I told this person, you know, the peace movement has been demanding peace. And now he wants to use us as a political tool again. And you're going to fall for it?
Right, yeah. No, it's very unfortunate, and this is where the PDA really, I mean, you know, the PDA supports something that even, you know, leftists are for, like domestic policy.
Right.
I mean, I'm you know, I'm for single-payer insurance, I really am. I'm for a great big green jobs program. I
Absolutely.
The PDA people and Bernie Sanders says he's for. I think, you know, I think he may be sincere about single-payer. I think Bernie may be sincere about green, you know, green jobs program, the infrastructure. I mean, but, you know, they go, this empire stuff, you know, and go, and, you know, and so people like us, you and me, and others on the actual left, can't deal with all this imperial militarism. They say, well, he's not perfect, you know, we're some candidates to be perfect.
Right.
They say, you guys don't get it.
Yeah.
You can't pay for the domestic social programs that you say you're for when you support this empire, which eats up 57% of federal discretionary spending. It's this great sucking chest wound that takes energy and skill and money and you know, away from what we need to do. And if you know all of Scandinavia, we need to be more like Scandinavia. Well, guess what? Norway, Sweden, Finland, and what's the other country? Denmark. Their defense budget is about 4% of their overall spending. And there's a reason for that. They invest to some extent. I mean, I don't romanticize those countries, but they live real welfare states.
Right.
And we don't. And we don't because we have such a warfare state.
That's perfect. So to me, Sanders is an imperialist, and I can't ever support that. I can't support, I always say, Gaza forever, Bernie for never. But... this is the last question. You brought this up in your article, and when I send out the newsletter for this show, I'll link like many, many of your articles. But
oh, super, thank you.
Is it reasonable or realistic for people, the Sandernistas, to think that someone like Bernie Sanders could actually push or pull someone like Hillary Clinton to the left?
Oh, no. No. Hillary has died in the woke corporatist. I mean, this goes way back. I mean, I people ought to read them. There was a nice article in the Harper's recently by Doug Henwood a while back, which really recounts the Clinton's history, which I think we need to be looking at right now. Going all the way back to Arkansas in the 1970s and the 1980s, I mean, the Clintons were pioneers of what became the Democratic Leadership Council. They were in the vanguard of moving the Democratic Party further away from labor, further away from civil rights, further away from peace, you know, Chris Hitchens wrote a wonderful book called No One Left to Lie To, and there's this wonderful section in it where he talks about Hillary just totally dismissing single payer when the healthcare debate arose during the first Clinton administration. I mean, and here was the head of Physicians for National Healthcare Plan from Harvard Medical School, David, I think it was Himmelstein, and he had with him all these statistics, including the Congressional Budget Office's calculation that that single payer would be the most cost-effective, best plan. Imagine what we could keep their doctors, the federal government would save money. The best thing we could ever do. And she just yawned, dismissed him, and said, David, tell me something interesting. You know, in advance of that fiasco corporatist plan that no one could understand, that then, you know, went up in smoke. I mean, Bernie Sanders refers to her, I've seen this in person in Iowa City, as a very good friend.
Right.
You know, did this my good friend Hillary Clinton. If he was at all serious about really being an independent and just sort of agonizingly happy he had to make this painful decision to come back and run as a Democrat, would he be saying in advance, I will give my voters and I will give my delegates to Hillary Clinton, you know, when it comes to the general election? I mean, is he even going to go through the pretense, or at least, you know, what am I trying to say? Is he even going to try to extract anything? And would he at least say, well, I would give my voters and would my delegates, you know, if, you know, and it's still in the blank, you know, is she committed to, I don't know, single-payer insurance? Or, I mean, even Dennis Kucinich used to say that Obama was promising him a department of peace, right? And that was a joke. But, I mean, he's not even making a show of trying to get anything for his support. So, you know, come on.
You bring up Dennis Kucinich, and Dennis Kucinich would actually promise his supporters that he would not do that, that he wouldn't support a warmonger, but then he always ended up doing it.
Yeah,
and his supporters would always be, oh, no, Dennis betrayed us. But like you said,
Dennis and some of these other progressives that have run as Democrats is that you would see them here in Iowa with their pie charts. And they would talk about the defense budget and
right. Well, Dennis and Pentagon system.
How much
that,
is he? This
right?
is gone now. Sanders has obliterated that. We're not even. Yeah. I mean, I saw that in 2007. I saw a lot of progressives around here putting on their lawns. I liked it. That's because the Iraq War was going on, and everyone hated the Iraq War, and they were able to hate it because it was being done by a Republican president. You know, Al Gore had been doing it; might have been different. They had a Republican president fighting a terrible war. So I had the pie charts out there. Well, you know what? Where's the pie charts now? Oh, you still got the same Pentagon system, you know. And now you're going to have people saying, well, Bernie, he really is anti-war because they can find little quotes from him where he's been critical of bloat right. and the Pentagon system. Well, you know, okay. Now you can get that from Republican senators, too.
Exactly. Well, Paul,
but I digress.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Is there anywhere you'd like to point my listeners? Like I said, I will be linking a lot of your articles and et cetera.
Well, I will say this. I do tend to, when I get around to it, take all the pieces I do, the Black Agenda Report and Counterpunch and put them on my website, which is www.paulstreet.org.
Perfect.
And they can get my email there and contact there, too, because I do some speaking. And anyone, any anti-war people, or leftists, or progressives, environmentalists, you name it, ever want to reach out to me, they can do that through the website.
And what about, talk about your latest book for a bit.
Oh, well, it's called They Rule, The 1% Versus Democracy. It's by Paradigm Publishers, and it was an effort to get away a little bit from just being considered a guy who didn't like Obama, didn't like the Tea Party. In other words, it's an effort inspired very much by Occupy to look at the whole system, to look at the whole corporate and imperial system beneath and beyond just particular politicians or parties or political tendencies. And even with all that ambitiousness, it's a pretty quick read. It's a pretty quick and I think good read. Brings together a lot of information and has a lot to say about what needs to be done too. I'm very big on not just being a Mandarin intellectual standing up on an ivory tower. I talk a lot about what we could do, what we need to do, and all of that.
Well, great. So Paul Street, that's They Rule by Paul Street, and I'll put a link to that too in the newsletter and the website. So Paul, thank you so much for giving your time and being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Absolutely. I enjoyed it very much, Cindy.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's the Soapbox for this week. As always, I hope you were informed and inspired. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar, my assistant emeritus, Dee Dee Miller, who is valiantly battling her stage 4 breast cancer. I'd like to thank Paul for being on the show and for the work he does and for being a leader and us not getting burned again, BERNED. And as always, I'd like to especially thank you, the listener, for listening and supporting Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to, guess what? Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out for now.